On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Graham Nichols.
Well, both those people talk about a much more rich spiritual landscape that they feel like they've traversed and come back and tell us about. And they'll tell you about lower levels. They'll tell you about different kinds of beings, including what we would call evil or demonic beings, and then hierarchical beings up to things that we would associate with a lot of religious traditions. Or they'll tell you directly that they're related to some religious traditions. And I don't know how we can really have such a wall and say, well, you know, it's all going to be explained.
I don't feel there's a wall. I feel that I explored a lot of those kinds of ideas, but not just me personally, also the people I work with. It's not that I've ever dismissed it. It's more that I've tried to say, well, is this really what's going on? And tried to really dig beyond the preconceptions and step outside of the box a bit and say, well, you know, what might actually be going on, rather than just going with the pre-assumption that, oh, it's all spiritual and demons and angels and that kind of thing.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, we're going to return to the topic of out-of-body experience. As you just heard in the introduction, Graham Nichols is joining us again, and he has a fascinating take on not only what this phenomena is and how we can prove that it's real, but also some very concrete advice about how you can experience an out-of-body experience yourself. Anyway, here's my interview with Graham Nichols.
Today, we welcome back to Skeptico out-of-body experience expert Graham Nichols. Graham is here to talk about his fascinating new book, Navigating the Out-of-Body Experience. Hi, Graham. It's so great to have you back on Skeptico.
Hi, Alex. It's great to be back on.
So here we are, and I was looking over your new book. Fascinating, fascinating. And one of the things that really struck me is, on one hand, it's a very practical book, and it says right in there that the aim of this book is to help you have an out-of-body experience, which is fascinating, and we want to talk about that because you really take a rather novel approach to kind of throwing a whole bunch of different techniques at folks, and you actually have a really sound scientific basis for why you think that varied approach might work for people. But at the same time, and this is the other part of the book I wanted to talk about, the book is very much about the science of out-of-body experience and the science-related questions that it raises. So first, maybe you can say, am I getting that right? Are there really kind of these two aspects to the book?
Sure, yeah, very much so. I wanted to move it away from the heavily esoteric angle that's common in a lot of books. And I also really wanted to base the techniques on something solid and just go out there and see what actually works, rather than just repeating what so many books and so many other people have been saying for, you know, over 100 years. I wanted to see if, well, does this stuff really actually do what people say, and do we really have silver cords and energy bodies and all of these kinds of things that are talked about so commonly? So yeah, that was really the aim.
Okay, good. So I'll tell you what, let's leave aside for a second these scientific questions about OBEs, including about whether they really exist, whether there really is such a thing, because I guess that would be one of the first scientific questions. And also, I think we should leave aside for a minute the philosophical questions about what this would might mean for consciousness, materialism, questions of the soul, all that kind of stuff. And let's talk about the practical applications, because I think that's where a lot of people are going to be coming at this from. Tell us about your approach to helping people have these experiences.
Well, I think with my approach, as well as the scientific thing stuff that I've already mentioned, I think another thing that I really was noticing more and more as I work with people over time is that people are very different, and that some people will have particular skills in a certain area and other people will have completely different skills. I mean, it's
yeah. You seem to take this NLP approach, the neuro-linguistic programming. Now you can, which I thought was fascinating. Tell us how you came to include that in this.
Because it just made sense, really. This idea of modeling what someone actually does when they're having the experience, and then seeing if I can apply it to different people, and then seeing maybe more visual people might work better with more of a visual technique, and another person. Because I was just finding that constantly when I was working with someone, I'd offer them a technique, and they might say, "Oh, I can't visualize," or "Oh, I can't. I am not very physical. I have various health issues," or whatever. All different things would come up when I'm working with them, and it just became apparent to me, well, fit the techniques to the person rather than trying to fit the person to the techniques, you know.
Great, great. So, you know, just for folks who maybe aren't totally up to speed on that, it's, as you mentioned there, you know, some people are just drawn to, let's say, auditory stimulation. You know, these are the people who like to listen to music more and can really feel a connection with it. You know, that would be kind of one sign. And then some people obviously are more visual, and maybe they're more of a dreamer kind of type. And so that's what, in reading the book, you've just kind of say, go with it, go with whatever your kind of natural inclination is, because as you've discovered in your out-of-body experience work, all those sensory modalities are represented in the experience. So it's not like an either or thing. You can just kind of emphasize one or the other as a starting point. Am I getting that part right?
Yeah, totally. I think it is a factor that you can really go with the person's major skill or major sensory focus, but then also bring in all the other senses as well. So it's this, it's looking at the person as a whole, a complete approach and a very personalized approach. I mean, even bringing in emotions and things like that, you know, using an emotional focus, such as another person working with another person. So there's this building of connection, which again is backed up with telepathy research and things like that, that there's a strong link between individuals. And, you know, that can really help with the success rate of someone learning as well. So it's all about looking at the science, looking at the individual, and really working out the best approach for that person.
You know, Graham, another aspect of your technique that seemed interesting to me, and maybe you want to talk about, is this idea of immersion. What are you driving at there, and how did you come up with that?
I suppose in a sense it came from this hypnosis idea again. I think back in the late 90s, about 98, I was working on the first of the immersive structures that I've built specifically to induce OBEs.
And tell folks a little bit about that setup and that project, because I think it's fascinating.
Well, the first structure I ever built was called Epicene, and it was essentially a steel structure, like a kind of cage that was designed to suspend a platform, a kind of bed in the center. And that was suspended by steel wire. So it was the wire was almost invisible. So when someone walked in, they would almost see just this floating platform, essentially. They would get onto that and it would flatten out and feel very much like floating. And then there would be some of this, the early version of my infraliminal sound technology, and also a spoken hypnotic induction. So it had a few different levels to it. So the idea was that using all of those senses and the idea of suggesting to the person that they were floating and putting them into that context would increase the chances that it would trigger something unconsciously and lead to the out-of-body experience. And I found that very quickly with the infraliminal sound that the vibrational state became very, very common. Up to 90%+ of people were getting the vibrational state. And then a certain percentage of people beyond that would go into either some kind of remote perceptions, such as hearing or perceiving things at a distance, seeing things at a distance, or the full out-of-body experience.
Well, those are just some astounding figures percentage-wise, especially in a pretty controlled experiment in terms of everyone's going through the same experience. You can ask them before and afterwards. That's pretty impressive. It's very impressive. Let's talk a little bit about science. And I want to start out with one of the things you said in the book that just struck me. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but you say the design of your techniques is drawn primarily from the science of parapsychology. You want to tell folks how specifically parapsychology research has kind of informed some of these decisions you've made and techniques you've developed?
Well, I think they've given this underlying inspiration in terms of looking at people like Michael Persinger's research with the God Helmet, or the research of Robert Munro, or even my work with Rupert Sheldrake and the idea of telepathy and the emotional connection between people, and just thinking about this idea of is an out-of-body experience actually a psi experience when all of the senses are activated, if you like. So if you think about it in terms of a psychic might describe that they're clairaudient or that they're clairvoyant or whatever, they'll often have one sense that's more developed than another, and their information will come through in that way. A few of my friends who are mediums often talk in that kind of context. So that gave me the idea that maybe what we're dealing with an out-of-body experience is actually where those psychic functions are all activated, so that it's like a complete multi-sensory experience. Because in a way, we're obviously not really experiencing senses when we're out in that situation, because I mean, we're not seeing light through lenses in a physical body kind of context. There must be something else at play. So it seems to me that we're almost translating the information that's coming through in whatever form that might be. And as we're translating that information, we do it into something that's familiar or understandable. And that's more of a why it's in a kind of sensory context, I think. But I think that's also why one sense can be more developed than another, or maybe one sense won't be active at all, or things like that.
That's fantastic speculation. I mean, it's really interesting. At the same time, I feel challenged in a way. You know, I remember interviewing Raymond Moody, and he would talk about the near-death experience, and he'd say it's pre-scientific. It used to always rub me, you know, in the way that Dr. Raymond Moody can kind of grind a little bit on stuff where he's in the middle of something and can't just come out and say it. But in thinking about that, I wonder if we are pre-scientific or maybe even post-scientific, because when you talk about those things and you talk about, well, that maybe we are reinterpreting what impressions we're getting and putting them in sensory terms so that they can be reintegrated into our experience, isn't that all necessarily, by definition, outside of what we can really wrap our arms around in terms of measuring, in terms of science? I mean, now we can't even identify these variables, let alone pretend that we're controlling for them in some kind of experiment. Don't we have a fundamental problem with science as soon as we step into this realm of consciousness beyond our body?
I think I have to agree with you to a certain degree. I think we are in a situation where at this point in time we're not quite there for sure. There's so little OBE research that's actually been done that I think there's still so much potential here to look into all of those kinds of questions. I think what I was meaning more when I was talking about that inspiration and those speculations, as you say, it's more in the sense of looking at it in a practical way. I think I was thinking, well, how can we find ways to enhance all of this in the sense of allowing someone to get more successful results? And I think that's what I meant when I talked about the science underlying what I was exploring. In terms of looking at it to understand exactly what the experience is, I think we really need to do some research. I think it's crazy that there's so little that's been done, and unfortunately I haven't really even come across many scientists who are open to doing research in this area. I've spoken to a whole range of scientists since our last interview, in fact, about doing some veridical research and doing some research in this area, and most of them, well, all of them have either been too busy with other things or not had the resources or whatever. So it's a real area that's just underexplored, and that amazes me, because when you read books that are exploring the science on the topic, they seem to go back to Robert Munro and start talking about the 1960s and Charles Tart's research, and it's, you know, the Miss Z experiment and things like that. It's crazy, really.
You make a good point, because as you're alluding to, fundamentally, it's a very simple experiment on one level, if we ignore the kind of deeper philosophical materialism, consciousness kind of things, and just say, okay, are you able to identify something outside your window or fly 1,000 miles away and see it? I mean, these are high school level kind of or lower level kind of experiments that can be done, right?
Sure, yeah. And I think your guest a couple of weeks ago made a really good point about that, of he's trying to work in a spontaneous sense, looking at the spontaneous experiences, and I really agree with that notion, because I think that historically maybe the problems that have arisen with doing any kind of OBE research is literally just the controllability in the context of putting someone in a lab and saying, okay, now just do this, you know, on tap. And you know, even people of Robert Munro's experience found that difficult to do, or there's certain limitations on doing that and the depth to which the experience can go, etc. Whereas if it's done where the experience happens in a spontaneous context, and then that's re-examined afterwards by people who can verify what took place, I think that's a stronger context.
You're an interesting person to ask, since you have both the personal experience with this as well as experience in helping and working with so many other people who've achieved this out-of-body experience. What do you think is going on as it relates specifically to this mind-brain thing, which, as we've explored on this show many, many times, seems to be clearly under attack in terms of the materialistic paradigm, that your consciousness is purely a product of your brain, that you are this biological robot? I mean, I think that's violated in a number of ways, but would you say that this is clearly violated by your experience with out-of-body experience and helping other people? Or is there some way that maybe somewhat of a materialistic explanation for this phenomena is possible?
I tend to lean towards that it's a combination. I tend to think that it's maybe not either or. I think that maybe there are factors that are dependent upon the brain, and that there are factors that are extended beyond the brain. I tend to see it something like that. I don't think that the type of consciousness experienced when out of the body is identical to the type of consciousness experienced within the body. It often has actually more capabilities and more possibilities than you would have in your everyday reality. I mean, a student I was coaching online just yesterday was talking about an experience she had where all of her sensory awareness, in fact, her sense of reality itself, was more heightened and more precise in the experience she had than in everyday reality. On a broader level, though, I think it's definitely the case that there appears to be something happening beyond the physical brain, for sure. I can't see any other way to approach it, really, when you're dealing with people who are flatlined, for example, in near-death experience situations, and even within the whole OBE literature, these experiences where people are so far beyond any way that they could be working in a sensory context.
It was somewhat of a lob question, and maybe that's unfair, but I like your answer, and especially the last part. One of the barriers to this, I think, is just how it's so obviously false. you're outside of your body, having some kind of sensory experience without your senses. It's clearly violating the mind equal brain paradigm that we're in, because it's so rigid, the materialism as we understand it, as it's taught in our science curriculum throughout high school and universities, is so rigid that of course this violates it. And the obviousness of that, I think, sometimes makes it a little bit hard, where we have to kind of dance around and go, well, you know, it could be this, it could be that. It's like, but clear that, as you say, it might be a little of this, it might be a little of that, but at the end of the day, we have to say, clearly this violates the strict mind equals brain model.
For sure. And actually, there's another area with all of this that I'm becoming increasingly interested in, and that's the whole area where people perceive an apparition of the person while they're out of their body, which takes place both in near-death studies and in OBE experiences. Some of my students have had situations where they've seen someone, they've been seen by, say, their close partner or whatever at another location. And that opens up a whole other area as well. I mean, in Penny Sartori's research as well, one of the significant cases was actually a man who perceived his sister. And the sister had actually passed away, but he didn't know that. And he was at the point of dying, and he was communicating in the ward with his sister. And then I think it was about a week later, he found that his sister had actually died. So there's these factors that really challenge and open up this whole area, even beyond the idea that just consciousness and the experience of the individual, but the experience of other people as well. And this interesting factor of, they often perceive the person as they actually are at that particular point in time, even down to their clothes, which is interesting again, because, well, why would you be wearing clothes in this kind of context? I've heard skeptics bring this kind of idea up. Well, why would a ghost wear clothes, or why would an OBE person be wearing clothes while they're out of the body? But if you look at it in terms of the consciousness concept, then we think of ourselves, we project ourselves, we experience ourselves in terms of memories and things like that as wearing clothes. So if we're dealing with some kind of consciousness at a distance, then it would make sense that we would project some image of ourselves as we understand ourselves. So there's this whole other area that I find very fascinating related to all of this.
Or they are somehow projecting with us or interacting with us. But it always, I agree with you, it does always seem like a rather strange objection on the part of a skeptic. It's to kind of jump past the unbelievable nature of experiencing something outside of your body and then focus on a detail of the clothes or the particular style of the clothes. Why would they wear a robe? You know, it's interesting. But you've kind of opened up another area, a whole other area that I think is important that we get into a little bit, because for the most part, your book takes a very, I guess you'd almost say, secular approach to out-of-body experience. But I'm compelled to kind of drive into this question of the spiritual, and it came up in my last episode with Rupert Sheldrick, and unfortunately you haven't had a chance to listen to that because it's still being edited. But can we really remove ourselves from the spiritual questions here, because they just seem to be so pressing to me, and they're monumental. I think they're at the core of our culture, really, and they're really at the core of science, although that's obscured a lot of times because we get in these really ridiculous sidetrack debates about evolution or about religion and all the rest of these. But I think fundamentally, this is the question we've tasked science with. Who are we? And then when we get answers that point us in a spiritual direction, I mean, apparitions like you're talking about, or people being deceased and their consciousness being embodied in some, I can't even say embodied because we don't know where that consciousness is, but it seems to be able to interact with us. To what extent do we really need to put those issues first and tackle and try and understand that spiritual territory in its broadest sense?
Well, I see them as interrelated, really. I suppose I don't see the spiritual as implying the supernatural, if that's what you're getting at. I think for me, the spiritual is this this level of conscious awareness, or this idea of growth and progression and change that takes place through all of these natural factors of reality. You know, I think that consciousness seems to be extended beyond the body, and that we experience all of these things without the body and whatever. I think that there's just this underlying aspect, it seems, to nature, and I think that factor will be identified and learned more about as time goes on through this kind of science.
But aren't we by definition talking about the supernatural, talking about something beyond nature, because nature is this box that we've drawn around in science. So we can kind of re-engineer those terms, but I think we're talking about supernatural.
I think the definition of nature has maybe broadened from that kind of idea since quantum physics and areas like that, because a lot of the notions of how things would have worked put in the past, I think have now expanded beyond that. You know, I don't think we're limited to saying that everything is black and white and works in a very mechanical way. I think quantum physics has thrown that kind of idea out. So I think now we're still very much exploring how those interconnections might work on a very, very tiny level. And I think that might open up these understandings of what's going on in a new way. So what might have seemed supernatural, I think maybe I just see that eventually that kind of idea will just become part of the natural, or part of the world that we understand. I think that the OBEs and things like that will probably be some kind of interconnection, like Brian Josephson's biological utilization of quantum numericality, this idea that our neurons, that our brains, that our minds are extended beyond the brain itself, through some kind of quantum mechanism.
See, that's interesting. Your answer is very much in line with Dr. Rupert Sheldrick there. So you guys are on the same page. And I'm not against that. I think that once we cross that chasm, we have to start trying to incorporate in a whole bunch of other experiences that before we've just kind of left on the sidelines. And I just don't know how we can walk that fine line, the fine line that you're walking, in terms of, okay, don't worry, science, in quotes, science will figure this out eventually. I think once we cross that line, then we have to talk about a little bit, you know, we were talking about Robert Bruce, you know, and his experience, or I was mentioning Marilyn Hughes, a former guest on this show, with the Out-of-Body Travel Institute or something like that. But really, a lot of her ideas sound very strange, but I have to tell you, in the experiences I've had with her, she's demonstrated to me some rather remarkable abilities. Well, both those people talk about a much more rich spiritual landscape that they feel like they've traversed and come back and tell us about, and they'll tell you about lower levels. They'll tell you about different kinds of beings, including what we would call evil or demonic beings, and then hierarchical beings up to things that we would associate with a lot of religious traditions, or they'll tell you directly that they're related to some religious traditions. So I guess my point is, you know, I think we're obligated to really take that stuff much more seriously once we cross over and say, yes, this really is happening in a way that we think is real or scientific. Then I think these things come into play, and I don't know how we can really have such a wall and say, well, you know, it's all going to be explained.
Oh, sure. I mean, I don't feel there's a wall. I feel that I've explored a lot of those kinds of ideas. I mean, I've studied the Kabbalistic interpretations of this stuff. I've looked at the astral projection literature, theosophy, you know, all these different areas. I've studied them over the years. I've been interested in this kind of area, and was probably less scientific in the past, but more and more I found that those things just didn't hold up.
didn't hold up in terms of as you went and tried to explore them yourself and validate them, you couldn't personally validate them, which I think is that what you're saying?
But not just me personally, also the people I work with. And it became more and more common that I was realizing that a lot of the preconceptions, I mean, a classic one that you can talk about, for example, is the silver cord. When you read astral projection literature, the silver cord is constantly mentioned throughout the literature for going right back probably to Muldoon and Carrington's famous book in the 1930s and whatever. So you've got this idea of the silver cord being there. But then when I've actually worked with people, they pretty much unanimously say to me, I haven't seen a silver cord. I haven't experienced one. What's going on? What's going wrong is sometimes what they say to me. I think we get into a problematic area. My first teacher, when I was around 15, turned around to me one day and said, oh, but of course you can't see in color when you have your out-of-body experiences, can you? And I looked at him quite confused by that. But because of his ideas that he'd drawn from Alice Bailey and various theosophical traditions, he believed that you had to be over 18 or a level of maturity before you would be able to see in color. My experience was colorful from the beginning. My very first OBEs were very colorful, and even rich blue energy was around me when I had my first OBE when I was around 14. So, I started to question a lot of that kind of idea. So it was more, it's not that I've ever dismissed it. It's more that I've tried to say, well, is this really what's going on? And tried to really dig beyond the preconceptions and step outside of the box a bit and say, well, you know, what might actually be going on, rather than just going with the pre-assumption that, oh, it's all spiritual and demons and angels and that kind of thing. If I saw those things, or if I saw consistency across cultures and with everyone I worked with, I would take those things on board. But the thing is I don't see that. So it doesn't give me a strong reason to take them on board.
Great. Well, so Graham, for folks who are interested in getting their hands on navigating the out-of-body experience, how do they do that? Is it on Amazon? I'm sure it's on Amazon in the UK. Can you also get it from Amazon in the US?
Well, actually, it was published in the US through Llewellyn, so it's got very good distribution, so it should be in bookshops and on Amazon. And
great. So it's easier to get in the US than to get in the UK, huh?
It is indeed, yeah.
And tell folks a little bit about your personal training, because I understand you're still doing that for people who want to personally have the best chance of having this kind of experience.
Yeah, I've developed that whole program quite a lot. So now I work in a one-on-one way with people over a month or 2 months or however long they want to work. And they get to use my infraliminal sound technology through that as well. And yeah, I just guide them through, work with a personalized program, use a diary that they can put notes in, and then we, you know, improve and go step by step through the process too.
The easiest way to find you, probably Graham Nichols OBE would probably get you there, huh, in a Google search?
Sure, just Graham Nichols. It comes up top. So
awesome.
With two L's.
The two L's. Okay, great. You've mentioned that you've tried to make connections with researchers to move this forward in the lab. Any prospects for that in the near future?
I was talking to a couple of researchers in the UK who are interested in doing a bit of research, but waiting to see what happens on that. I'm also doing some research with the infraliminal sound in terms of beneficial applications for that, working with people with various problems like drug addiction and things like that, because it seems to get people to a very positive balancing state of awareness, which seems to help with those kinds of things. It's already been tried with a small group, and there's possibly a pilot study happening in around 6 months in Ireland. So there's a few exciting things on the horizon with that.
Well, Graham, it's fascinating work and a great book. I hope everyone gets a copy of it and tries some of these techniques. But you have to create some space in your life and get into that mode where you can really relax and let go a little bit, which was a challenge for me. But I think it's really worthwhile. Best of luck with the book, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thanks again to Graham for joining me today on Skeptico. A couple of questions to tee up from this interview. The first would be, what are we to make of Graham's extraordinary out-of-body experiences? Now, I have to tell you, I've known Graham for several years, and he's always come across to me as a very credible guy. Nothing he's said and in the class that I did with him has ever made me question that in any way. As a matter of fact, it's only bolstered my feeling that he is legit. He is who he says he is. At the same time, I wonder how we can really analyze his experience and how we can compare it with other experiences. Maybe we can't. Maybe we can. Maybe these experiences are so personal that they can only have personal meaning. But then again, that's why I think we approach these topics in the way that we do, from Skeptico, from a scientific standpoint. And that is because we want to compare and contrast them with other people who seem credible, who have these experiences, and maybe have a different take on them. So I guess the question and all that wrapped up for a forum discussion is, what are we to make of the variety of extraordinary paranormal experiences? And what methodology can we use to kind of tease apart what's most, for lack of a better term, real? And the second question that I tee up would come back to this issue of spirituality. Do you think that these out-of-body experiences might be happening in a non-spiritual way? Might they be something akin to a natural phenomena? And how would we know something like that? So those questions might not be perfectly formed in the way that I've said them so far, but then you'll have an opportunity to reform them and recast them in the way that you see fit. The place to do that, of course, is at the Skeptico website, which you'll find at skeptiko.com. Don't forget the K in there. And from there, you can link to our forum. You can add a comment to the comment section of the website, or you can track me down on Facebook or via email. Well, that's about it for today. I have a number of interesting interviews coming up. We're going to be tackling a wide variety of topics in the next couple months, as well as returning to some old tried and true territory that I just can't get away from, including debates with atheists. So stick around for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.